This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 18th of November, 1953. The title of this lecture is Step 2, Automaticities. This tape is 59 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions. Please note, this tape ends abruptly as did the original master recording.
And this is November the 18th, first afternoon lecture. First thing I want to tell you is, while I appreciate the fact that sooner or later you may feel you're going to instruct in this subject, I hope I'm not teaching your notebook. I hope I'm not auditing your notebook. That's a fact. That's right. I hope you're not auditing on that basis. When you sit down in front of a PC, you want this stuff in your head. And I'm trying to cover it over and over, backwards and forwards, over the same ground and so forth, to put it in your head. Ready? I want you to have this material so when you sit down and the preacher starts to scream, and jump up and jump out the window and so forth and go through the normal American evolution of being processed, that you've got the data pang right there verbally. And if you've got the data right there verbally, by that time you'll be having no trouble with your case either. Now don't get self-conscious, still want to put down notes in your notebook, that's all right with me. And I'm telling you not to put notes down in a notebook, go ahead. And make sure that I'm putting it in your head, not your notebook. A lot of people have a beautiful circuit, and some people have gone all the way through a university teaching a notebook. And they get all the way through, of course, sometimes some goofball professor says, now let me see your notebooks and make sure that they're thoroughly taught. That's right. I know one professor used to grade solely on the notebook. So we had a system. We just handed him in the same notebooks at the end of every course. He took them. Nobody ever bothered to repair in class. He never noticed. He'd gotten it teaching down to an automaticity, the like of which we'd never heard of before. But this morning, by George, while I was processing you, we had some of the processing going down in the notebook. Well, now, by golly, I didn't like auditing that notebook. Because the person doing it needed processing. All right. Now let's understand the purpose of these lectures I'm giving you. They aren't actually what you would put under the label of I'm trying to teach you something. The truth of the matter is I'm trying to unteach you. If I'm doing anything, it's that. And if I can succeed in unteaching you, a lot of automaticities and preconceptions and so forth will be successful. You wonder why I said we ought to have something called American procedure. We ought to have something called American procedure very, very neatly, because this is the most automatic country on the face of the earth today. Talking about space opera. Space opera used to be a lot of fun, you know. You spend 2 hours getting into your suit and you get all this equipment and you get it all here and there and you stuff it and put it in your pockets and then you climb up with this 200 pounds of stuff up a ladder that's about 30 feet tall to get into some kind of an airport. And you get inside this ship, you see, And you regulate about 500 switches, and you have to repair 4 or 5 electronic circuits, and you patch some things together with chewing gum, and you strap yourself down in the seat and take off, and then you navigate like mad, going 3 times the speed of light, trying to navigate by stars that are invisible for some days, and then you land someplace with the skin of your teeth, and boy, you really knew you did something. That's right, you really knew you did something. All right, space opera toward the end of that time. Got into this kind of a circumstance. He did this over and over and over again. A fellow went down and he climbed aboard a little trolley and got in his trolley and then took him on up and he ran in the Sipsy and he sat down in the chair and the chair strapped him in and adjusted his oxygen and so forth. And the chair decided that he was well enough seated and well enough strapped in and the ship took off on a prearranged course to a prearranged destination at a prearranged speed. The chair and instruments and so forth took very good care of him, fed him and breathed him until he got there and landed him safely at the spaceport. He got out. Nobody knew he'd done a thing because he hadn't done anything. It was all automatic. The people who'd done it was the technicians. All right, let's compare that with what we're doing with a preclear. And we find out that in those areas where an individual is accustomed to having everything done for him, you push a button and so on, and that happens, we're going to get rough cases. We're going to get the roughest cases out of the person who's pushed the most buttons. Just like that. His life is running on a push-button basis. It means that the society itself is busy keying in all of his automaticity, and one of the first things it keys in is occlusion. Pang! There he goes. It's all automatic. He knows he didn't do anything. Now, if you could just get a preclear to go out, just getting to go out and take an axe and knock a fence to pieces all the way down the fence, at the end of that time, he'd know he'd done something. Wasn't any fence there anymore, just a bunch of splinters. He'd know that he'd done something. You get that? Now, this automaticity goes further than that. It goes viciously further than that. It goes to the point where they expect the auditor to do it all. They think somehow or other, if they push a button on the auditor will run for a certain number of hours, and they will be clear. The hell they will. I won't. That's the end of it. So it's up to you as an auditor to knock out the second stage, and it comes under step two of SOPHC, which is automaticity. And the way you do this, you see, the earliest shadow of this is mock up the body. You have him mock up the body several times until he's used to having the body outside him. He doesn't collapse the terminal on it the second he stands outside, and then he's outside. Why are we doing that to a body? I'm doing that to a body in areas where I've been around for about 8 months. The reason why is he's setting up the most automatic thing he's got. It talks for him, it squawks for him, it speaks and sees and hears, and it even has gotten to a point where it combs its own hair and it drives properly without direction and so on. Cause level of the body may be pretty good on a number of subjects, but a person stops causing them. Having a hobby is simply being cause level over some kind of an automaticity. It's being a super control over the top of something that is super controlled. You see that? Somebody takes up the hobby of postage stamps. Well, that's not very automatic, but the fellow that takes up the hobby of ham radio is at least being cause level over a terrific amount of automaticity. And you know he keeps on being cause as long as he keeps building and rebuilding equipment. If you go into a ham radio shop, or if you go into a ham radio shack, you will find equipment and machinery and everything lying around all the time, and he's going to build and he has just fixed. If you happen to clip the switch and listen to a couple of hams talking, what are they talking about? Are they talking about their wives or children? No, those poor people, the wives and children, have been forgotten long since, except when Irma comes in, is permitted to say, "Hello, Joe. Yes, I'm glad that you installed the 6018 like you did." Mm-hmm. Well, goodbye, Joe. The wife's permitted to step into the thing to that degree. She's kind of automatic, too, by that time. And when we have a conversation, it is a highly technical conversation about what they did to make something else more automatic. And a ham radio quits. He just quits cold. One of these boys stops when he can't build it any better. I swear some of them, if they really thought they were reaching that goal, would at least plug in something on the wrong power line and blow it out. You can trace back most of the accidents and so forth they have to just this anxiety not to have it work too well. Now, some people run bodies that way. Body starts to work all right, and then they get afraid that it's going to be too doggone automatic, and they start clipping off the various things it can do and making it tough for themselves. They wreck it in order to repair it. Nearly every case you have coming in has been pushed into this category, except somebody who's been directly PDH'd. And he's had an automaticity set up for him that is simply dependent upon an early automaticity that he'd like to be unconscious. That would be fun, too. All right. What's this amount to in auditing? It means that you as an auditor have got to be prepared to be cause. How can you be cause? Well, the best way to be cause is to use the most basic mechanisms that you can possibly use to resolve a case. If you want to resolve a case of occlusion, the best thing to do is to take the very mechanism which takes occlusion and makes occlusion and continues occlusion. And what is that? It's an automatic machine that makes conclusions and occlusions, and it makes exclusions. And it's got all of these various things, and it keeps jamming them in on the PC. He was happily using this machine on other people and other people and other people and other people, and this was all swell, except one day the darn thing got busted and wouldn't go and worked all of a sudden on him. The machine's working on another person target when it's working on his body. When he thinks he has lost somebody that he needs, get this. He then has lost somebody he needs. Is that so? So the machine which is set up to run on lost clicks in. That's real simple enough. The relay switches on these basic machinery is Q&A. Lost? The machine goes, lost! Crunch, crunch, crunch. So it loses him. See? And it makes him invisible. Now, he's got other machinery that will set up the same way. He drives somebody insane, so forth. He's got a machine there that he's going to use to drive somebody crazy. He keeps using it. He keeps using it. Then all of a sudden, he suddenly realizes he has driven somebody a little bit off. He has reduced somebody's sanity, and the machine goes to work on him. He goes to college and decides the best way to do and get through college real hard is to concentrate like mad. And he concentrates and concentrates and concentrates until he gets cross-eyed. You can always tell this boy, because when you tell him to look at the space around an object, his attention immediately snaps to a point beyond the object, slightly beyond the object. It doesn't even converge on the object. It's no space in the object is what he gets. He is scarcity of space, concentration. Two, concentrated in attention. So he sets up this machine so that he can study. He sets it up so he can go into a lecture room and push a little button, sit there, and he'll come out. And at examination time, he expects this machine to unreel for him 3¾ meters of chemistry. The school system sets it up so he'll do that too. They keep telling him, a student has to learn how to study. And the most part of that is concentration. So he sets up machines to do this. And then one day he has to concentrate too hard on life. How does he do that? Well, he gets into an automobile accident, and just before the accident, a glaring headlamp is right between his two headlamps, and he's looking right straight at that glaring headlamp, and then there's a sudden crash. He's convinced by now, but it turned the machine on. What machine? Thorough concentration turns on the machine, which thoroughly concentrates. Is it an actual machine? Does it have nuts and bolts? No, it doesn't. It has just as much nuts and bolts as that microphone has nuts and bolts. In other words, it's just the real universe, and so it is something he put there with postulates. This is all there is to that machine. But he recognizes it in terms of automaticity and machinery. Why does he want automaticity in the first place? It's very simple. He wants automaticity because of the subject of randomity. What is randomity? Randomity is the amount of predicted and unpredicted motion which a person has. That's all. It's a ratio. The amount of predicted motion in ratio to the amount of unpredicted motion which the individual has. And he likes to have about 50% predicted motion, about 50% unpredicted motion, and that's his idea of tolerance level on randomity. What is randomity? Unpredicted motion. You go down the street, you go down the same street every day, nothing ever happens on the street. You walk into the same gate, you ring the same doorbell, you go into the same house, you eat the same dinner, and so forth and so on. And boy, there's nothing unpredicted there. You go down that street every day, so forth. And after a while, you're driving around, and you suddenly decide you'll drive down that street and have a wreck. At least put something on that street that is an unpredicted motion. So you've got to pretend you didn't predict the motion in order to have an unpredicted motion. That's the tombstone which sits over the head of every unaware thing. I've got to pretend that the motion is unpredicted in order to have an unpredicted motion. And that is the basis on automaticity. The basic problem is he wants to be surprised. Now you get a thing to take and mark up a box. Now put something in the box that you don't know is there so that when you lift the lid, you won't know it's there and you'll be surprised. So he'll do that. And then he lifts the lid and it goes pang. And he's very happy about it. That's unpredicted motion. Now when you give a person all unpredicted motion or nearly all unpredicted motion, boy, he gets real frantic. He hasn't enough predicted motion to stabilize him. So he doesn't know where he is. He gets lost. Why, he has to be able to predict where the 8 corners of this room will be tomorrow morning. You know there's room here, right? All right, supposing you fixed it up or fixed him up by processing machinery till the 8 corners of this room started appearing all over the universe. And he wouldn't know where this room was going to be, so he didn't know where he was supposed to be the next morning. But that is super unprediction. Now that is too much randomity. As far as automaticity is concerned, it immediately springs out of this. You have to say, I pretend I don't know anything about it, so that a certain effect will occur. In other words, a person wants to be partially an effect as well as partially cause. Well, he starts out with a chessboard. He mocks up a chessboard, and he decides to play chess with himself. So he sits on one side of the board, and then he moves around to the other side of the board. And then he moves back to the first side of the board, moves a knight, and moves to the second side of the board, and moves a bishop to counter the move of the knight, and he moves back to the first side of the board, and he moves out a pawn in order to guard the knight, and then he moves over to the other side of the board and puts a knight up in place in order to check the bishop and so on, and he looks at this, and he knows each time what the most is going to be. Of course, chess is a very unrandom game. You can forecast chess practically with the first... Given the first 3 moves of the game and 2 average players, you can always predict the end of the game. Boom. That's a very unrandom sort of game. It's a very interesting game, I guess. But they had lots of time in India. So, anyway, even with a game like this, a person says, look, it's somebody else that's got to be on the other side of that board. All right, so he goes over on the other side of the board, and he sits down on the other side of the board, and he says, I am somebody else. That's the first stage. And he comes back to the first side of the board. Kids do this. You can observe this. And he sits down the first side of the board and say, now my name is Bill, and I'm making this move. And I go around the other side of the board, now my name is Joe, and I'll make this move. And I'll go around here. And you'll, pretty soon you'll hear, you'd hear the person saying, as he was being Joe, Bill, that was too clever for me. Well, the next real stage of this is a very simple one. He sits on one side of this board, and he says, now there is a person on the other side of the board. And he's a real Abel Clayton. He simply mocks one up, endows it with life, and then occludes its identity. But gives it an identity and occludes its actual origin. And its actual origin is that he made it. Occlusion of actual origin is the first break over into an automaticity. An automaticity is something that will be done that something doesn't want to know anything about. The heck of it is that there is not a Thetan who can still make a body twitch, who himself is not capable of doing everything 100 times better than some cockeyed apparatus that he set up that would trigger when he thought a random thought. He could always do it better. And yet he's got machines that make his mock-ups. He's got machines that unmock things. He's got machines that unmock the meshed universe. He's got things that occlude the meshed universe. He's got things that unocclude it. He's got things that make it solid. He's got things that put up barriers where barriers are not supposed to be. He's done these things all the way down the track. And he's still got all his machinery. And he wonders why he's in a dwindling spiral. And the final end product of all of this is a body. Now you ask somebody to get out of the body. The body has been eating for him, thinking for him, spitting for him, and doing everything for him, giving him all of his sensations, so forth. As far as he's concerned, this thing called a body is the most automatic gadget he ever heard of. It's learned how to play bridge. It's learned how to play chess. It's learned how to play the piano. You get some boy in his last stages, he will simply tell you as he sits down to the piano, well, I don't pay much attention to it. My hands do all that. Sure, and he's got a sheet of music in front of him where Brahms is doing all the music. What's he doing sitting at the piano? Probably nobody listening to him either. So it goes from all ability to do everything, such as look at a piano and say, let's see, the way you play a piano is so and so, and probably melodies can come out. And let's see those strings. Those strings are very interesting. Those strings are various wavelengths, and they probably chord in this fashion. That's probably on, goes on cycle of eight, doesn't it? That's very fine. All right. Crash, something twice as good as the Moonlight Sonata. You think so? You think not? Probably this looks very horrifying to you, the thought of looking at the doggondest, biggest truck with 32 speeds forward. And maybe you couldn't even drive a car, and you look at this thing, and you say, let's see now, the motor and so forth, burn some kind of fuel or something. Yeah. It's got wheels, they could probably go wrong. Let's see, if the steering wheel goes this way, and now I have this slide over there, and there must be some way to make it go forward, and there must be some way to make it go backwards. The connections are so and so, well, those make it go forward, and go backwards. Oh, that's all we need. Okay, now that, some kind of storage, there's juice down there someplace. Yeah, that connects up a little more, and starts up, and there's got to be a full fuel over here. No, push the button there, throttle it here, push another. And go off down the road, doing a far better job than a truck driver. You see how foreign that philosophy is to the current philosophy? That if you just study real hard, and if you drive one to get the experience about 15 years, you will eventually know something about a truck, at least to the degree of being an assistant driver on a transcontinental ride. And of course, we all know that an airplane pilot has to have 4,000 hours in the air on all types of multi-engine aircraft before anybody would trust him to sit in the passenger seat, practically. We know that. All right, contrast that with a fellow who goes out and he says, gee, this thing must take a nice line of balance. Well, all right, let's take it into the sky and find out. Then you say, what the hell am I driving it from here for anyway? And go outside and put a beam on it and lug it across the San Francisco. Super, super, super automaticity. The more automatic things get, the less the individual. There's a definite law. The less automatic things are, the greater the feeling of accomplishment.
and the greater the knowingness. The more automaticity, the less the knowingness. The more automaticity, the less the certainty. The less automaticity, the more the certainty. The less the automaticity, the less the impacts. The more the automaticity, the more the impacts. Savez? It's a very simple problem. So we're taking step two. Step two consists of knocking out the machinery. And let's just knock it out and to hell with it. You can always put it back. This is one machine that if you take it apart, even vaguely, in an orderly fashion, if you at least pull the balance wheels out of this watch on the order of the first balance wheel it shows itself, one after the other, if you just go about it in that orderly fashion, and so on, it'll come out to the smoothest, slickest, cleanest job you ever saw in your life. But you'll be able to do anything. This doesn't mean you have to be permissive and let the preacher do anything he wants to do, because his favorite machine is the one you're gunning for. What do we get at the end of all machinery gone? We get somebody who can do anything. Just literally anything. Somebody was talking to me the other day who has no bearing on this particularly, but this shows you what on a relatively low level a person can do. As a kid, I used to have a lot of fun picking up the know-how on something else to do. And I'd pick up the know-how, and then I'd be bitterly criticized by somebody. Oh, but bitterly. You thought I'd robbed the mint or something, you see, because I could then do what I had picked up to do, but insisted that I could do it. And all the arguments, brother, they knew it took experience, and so forth. And that fact I never found out. And nobody was ever able to teach me this until sometime during the war. I was running a Corvette, and I had been called one time too many on an attack in the dark of night. The favorite time for the subs to attack was around 12, 1 o'clock when it was nice and dark. You know, a little bit later in the war, they were getting even worse. They used to attack 12 or 1 o'clock after the captain of the sub had finished breakfast, after a late breakfast, you know. He attacked convoys when he had good light, you know, I could see them. But early in the war, they were still being foolishly cautious. I never found out why they were being cautious early in the war, because there was certainly nothing attacking them. I'd just been called one too many times at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, when you're called, you've been up all day, and then you're called first at 11 o'clock, but that was a log that your sound operator picked up. And then you were called at 11:22. You'd just gotten back to sleep. And this time, it was an empty lifeboat. And no fight in it. So you go back to bed, and at 12:01, oh, you really sleep that time, you see, ring, and up you would go again to find out, of course, that it was merely a message which had come in on the battle channel, that there was a battle going on just to the south of you. You didn't have anything to do with that, so you went back to bed again. Well, the only trouble with this, and the way the automaticity got laid in, was, of course, I wanted it to be laid in, but I remember this sequence very vividly. At first, I merely had one call buzzer. You know, they hit it twice, and I would hit the bridge. That's all. I mean, it's very simple. They hit it twice, I'd hit the bridge, and then I'd hit the general alarm gong, if there was anything wrong. But war was speeding up a little bit, so we finally got up to two bops on this buzzer, which would simply go buzz, buzz, rather calmly up above my bed, and they would hit the general alarm simultaneously. Well, it was quite interesting because the general alarm gongs which they were issuing in World War I were merely World War II were merely automobile horns. They weren't general alarm gongs at all. They were stuff that they'd taken out of Buicks and Packards and automobiles, you see, and they'd just park them all the way around the ship, and these horns would suddenly open up. Somebody would throw a big lever on the bridge, and I'd switch on all these horns all through the ship. One, of course, would sit just outside my cabin. Bong! See, on would go the horn, and then two buzzers. Well, it was getting difficult to get out. Even with that, you see, you get really staggery after a while, kind of sleepy, you know, your body isn't hitting too well, and you're supposed to be in the state of beautiful sadness and exhaustion because it is a war, you're supposed to be doing something. So a telephone was run in. So the telephone bell, the buzzer, and the general alarm gong were hitting then. That was quite adequate and got along for a while until I missed one. So we put in another one. We put back into operation the old whistle tube. So another lookout would, on the upper bridge, would get on this whistle tube, and it screamed in my ear right there. And I'd be out on the bridge with the whistle tube. Well, that was all right, but I got through all of those, and one time didn't turn out for GQ. And neither the executive officer, it was, I think, our fifth GQ of the same night. And so after that, they sent a messenger down, too. In other words, we were actually building an automatic system. I was trying not to be there, you see. The war was saying, be there. And my God, I never realized that an automatic system had been worked up until about 1946. About spring of 1946, I was walking down the street, and a Buick pulled up to the curb right near me and blew its horn. And it set off this machinery. It set off the whole cockeyed works. And I got sleepy, and I got sleepy, and I got groggy, and I got a sort of a frantic feeling, and I looked around and couldn't find what I was looking for, which was, of course, the bridge steps. They were not in Los Angeles. And we got this thing, and it just got worse and worse. Every time I'd hear an automobile horn after that and so forth, I'd get nervous. It's upset. I knew I was supposed to go someplace, and I couldn't quite locate where I was supposed to go or what was supposed to happen, so I'd take it out on the automobile. And I'd say, well, go up there. What's he doing sitting there honking his horn? All right, I've only told you this for one reason. I want to show you that Los Angeles is not in the North Atlantic. Nor yet is it in the North Pacific, even though in the Pribilof some gay soul during the war planted the sign Los Angeles City Limits. They really aren't out there. They're actually just before you reach Hollywood, but they had it in the Pribilofs. Los Angeles is a small village which is located very close to the Salton Sea. They have some interesting press relations with the rest of the world, but that's not all. Anyway, here we have, all across the line, automaticity. It's the right signal in the wrong place, making you reach for and try to attain a goal which geographically is not present. And when an automatic machine starts doing that, we get anxiety, demand for motion, feeling of danger in the environment. All of these things come right on in. Tiredness, semi-unconsciousness, all of these things. What are they coming out of? They're coming out of one of these darn pieces of machinery. That's all there is to it. But the only machine on that whole channel that would count even vaguely is probably back there for this body a couple of hundred thousand or a couple of hundred million years someplace where it's all indoctrinated. It's supposed to answer to a certain stimulus response. Very early on the genetic line, even an anthropologist, a Darwinian, has long been recognizing this, that there's a sudden screech at night and a fellow turns around and starts to go into action with his teeth or something. Very often he will roar.
This lecture is continued on side two of this cassette.
By the way, did you ever do that? Be startled at night and turn around and yell? Roar like an animal? Something like that. I've seen people do it. They are jumped suddenly or startled. Well, an automaticity goes on in the body which tries to repel things away from it with sound. Well, I imagine that you'd see that the fingernails tried to shoot out a little bit longer and get a little sharper at about the same time. Certainly this action happens. The palm of the hand develops sufficient sweat to permit a person to hold on easily to rock. And the soles of the feet develop sufficient moisture to be able to stick to what they're on. so that a person can get traction. And you find anybody who has moist hands, he's in a state of perpetual signal saying danger, danger, and the equipment for him to put the automatic machine into action isn't present. There's no bridge ladder. See, something like the automobile horn is saying GQ, 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 and he isn't able to find the bridge ladder. So he's half unconscious, he's stumbling around, he's in a state of what they laughingly call nervous anxiety. It's just unable to finish a cycle of motion. Not nervous anxiety, that's one of these complicated definitions, doesn't mean a thing. It's just this thing, he can't finish the started cycle of motion. This machine is set to start running at any time signal X happens in the environment. See? When signal X occurs from the individual or the environment, the machine starts running. Yeah, but the environment shifted. And what do you know? Man has progressed as well in this society as he has been able to continue to be cause over a changing environment. He's never adjusted to the environment. He's adjusted ahead of the environment where he has survived. And so we have a continually changing environment, so the bridge steps are never present. The fellow's not in that locale all the time. The situation is never the same the second time. So you get your overt act motivator sequences. The situation, he's got a machine set up to whereby he's learned how to box. So when somebody takes a poke at his jaw, even though he's unconscious, why, he hits the other fellow in the solar plexus. See? That's an overt act. Now the other fellow goes down. So someday somebody comes along and hits him in the brisket. And he, of course, knows what he's supposed to do now. What? Go down. See, the other, it's machine's rigged, so that's the way it happens, you see. But some fellow comes along someday and hits him like that. Where is he supposed to fall? He's supposed to fall in the exact geographical location where the first time he dropped a guy. That's where he's supposed to fall. So ever since, he's trying to fall down on spot X, which is 1,000 miles away from where he is. He's never going to fall down on spot X, that's all. So an overt act motivator sequence stays in suspension. The machinery of attack and offense, defense and getaway, and apology is in continual re-stimulation. Just continual. So a fellow goes along the time track saying, what time track? Where am I? Just if I could just get my feet down someplace and say, this is X. Maybe I'm supposed to pass out when I reach X, but that doesn't matter as long as I've at least got X. Because it takes X to get the machinery running again. Then he feels it'll all come out all right. But it's never going to. And automaticity never answers a second occasion. And the prime mistake that a Phaeton makes when he sets up all these beautiful gimmicks and gadgets is that no matter how wonderful it was, it will never act for the second occasion. He puts machines away and forgets them so that they will act for a second occasion, but they never act for a second occasion. Some modified version, contradicted how many times, checked and counterbalanced, make it poorly workable a second time. It goes on in this purely workable fashion. You sit down at the wheel of a racing car, and if you've got lots of experience as a race driver, tremendous experience as a race driver, and you drive that car automatically, some kid is going to come along, 16 or 17, and this is his second race. And although every veteran driver on the track is going to say, my God, who let that car down? Who on this track? He ought to be shot, outlawed. The three A's ought to throw him on his ear. Everything else, the kid still wins the race. Why? Now, people go through this second stage. They realize that they have become too unalert. It's all too automatic. And they all of a sudden give the machinery a kick and step back and take a look at what they're doing. And just by the process of consciously doing it, here's a guy who becomes a veteran driver. All of a sudden he realizes he just lost his fifth consecutive race. Something's wrong. Well, sure it's wrong. So he looks this thing over carefully and decides to drive in another fashion. And this time he decides to drive the car, not to rely on the training that old Bill Wheelwright slipped him when he was a kid. Because that seems passe. He's not going to drive the car. So he drives the next race and he's a little better. And then he consciously drives the next race and he's a little better. And then he real consciously drives that next race. And the quivery feelings he was having by changing over style and things like that, these things are going by the boards. He isn't laying in another pattern. He's becoming more and more in command of the automaticity simply by doing it in the next universe. If you can just coax somebody to climb up the side of the Empire State Building, outside it, he would lose, I assure you, about the fifth trip up, all fear of height. By doing what? He's just getting command up and keying out all of his machinery. So you see, we have this truth sitting back of this about training. But people think that this is training. That's not what's happened. The person sets up a machine to do something, then depends upon the machine. Then the machine lets him down. Then he decides to hell with this automaticity, and he simply decides from there on to be cause. For instance, I was taking your pictures a short time ago. I had some of the most beautiful, beautiful photography machines you ever saw. I mean, it's gorgeous. I mean, they checked over everything automatically and saw that it was all right, and it's all wrong, and the time was proper, and well, as I said, it just checked over beautifully. And then, as time went on, why, the flash bulb wasn't in, the shutter was set at the wrong speed, and I mean, what was happening? The machine was breaking down. Because the machine is only as good as the person is conscious of it, and no better. And as he becomes less and less conscious of the machine, he becomes worse and worse. So all of a sudden, I decide to take pictures again. I go around, and each time I look at the camera, I say, how the hell does this thing work? Boom. Well, there's the slides. So on, that's right. Why? It's obvious how the mechanism works. You can look at it. You go around front and you look in the lens to see if the shutter's open or closed. Not is the thing on T or a 50th of a second. Well, I would have royally loused up the picture I was taking of you this morning because the camera, this beautiful piece of automaticity, was jammed on wide open, no matter where you turned the shutter. Well, immediately that you looked at the camera, you could see that the shutter blades were wide open. This is immediately apparent. But if you looked at the dials, it was supposed to tell you about some other dials, which were supposed to tell you about some other dials. Reminds me of a fellow taught something about diesel engines one time. We all had learned something about diesel engines because diesel engines they made during the war didn't run. And they were stationary, they take big, huge stationary light plant engines, you know, and strip all of the iron off them, supplant it all with aluminum, and then put them on a derrick and put them into a ship and run them at variable speeds. Real cute trick. So, you had engines 50% of the time, and sometimes even during an attack on submarines or something, your engines would keep going long enough for you to get away from the depth charges you just dropped. And the few times that engines would stop, well, ships were expendable because Navy Yard and shipyard workers have to work, you see, so it all worked out for the best, this best of all possible worlds. But it is embarrassing when engines keep stopping like that, so they decided that anybody going aboard this new type of Corvette was going to have to, the skipper one, was going to have to learn its engines too. This is an insult to any bridge man, you see. But I got to listen to this guy. He's an enlisted man. And he knew what he was talking about. Almost synonymous. This fellow had worked with these engines a long time. And he says, now, he says, I want to teach you about gauges. I want to teach you all about these little pyrometers. Name of the gauge is a pyrometer. It tells you how hot the engine is. Now, you know that a diesel engine has to run at a certain heat level in order to produce enough combustion on the injection. So he said, this pyrometer, you put it up there, you put up this pyrometer, and he says, you pay close attention to the pyrometer. And he said, after you carefully read the pyrometer, which tells you how hot the water is, and so forth, and after you've gone around and read all the rest of the meters, he says, then you go around and take a look at the engine. And he says, you put your hand on the water intake pipe and find out how hot it is. Now, he says, you should have a big tub sitting somewhere near the engine so that you can throw the valve open and fill the tub halfway in order to see how clean or how dirty the water is that's pouring through that thing and whether or not you can put your hands in it. Then he says you go around to the other end of the engine and you look at the bearings on it to see whether or not they have oil on them because this glints in the light. He said, but be sure and read those meters. As a consequence, of just that piece of instruction. We were all broken down outside of a harbor one day, and I kept yelling down at the engine room, trying to use words to affect something in this society. And I kept yelling at the engine room, funny. So I held it and went down there. Camshaft on the starboard engine. Won't budge. No oil. Must be bent. Must be warped. Looked at it. Nothing wrong. Getting oil. Must be warped. That must be what's wrong with it. I said, no, there's probably something dry on it if it's not turning. It's probably frozen someplace along the line. Probably frozen. Well, if you did get it unfrozen, you couldn't do anything about it because this gauge over here that says it's getting oil. I just remembered this guy just in time. I took a look at this gauge, and sure enough, the engine was not running, and the oil pressure pump was not running, which the engineer has neglected to note. And the oil pressure gauge was reading sufficient pressure. Wasn't that cute? The pump wasn't running. It gave it the pressure. So I sent for a couple of big pipe clippers and cut the pipes off and jammed the two ends together on a piece of rubber hose so no oil went through the gauge. And got a piece of crocus cloth and held it on the shaft while somebody rotated the shaft out at the other end. Took an oil can and squirted it full of oil. We started the engine and it ran. You know, after that I suddenly realized that everybody that went aboard one of those ships that wasn't willing to go down in the engine room every once in a while would have trouble with his engines. And I never had trouble with another one of those engines. Never did have any more trouble. Why? Because every once in a while I'd go down the engine room and take a look at them. And they'd sit there and they'd run. Furthermore, I'd often go along the side of the ship and take a look at their exhaust ports. And if they started pouring out vast clouds of black or green or white smoke or something like that, well, I'd get on the phone and say, what the hell is happening down there now? Oh, sir, we just turned on the air injector too quick. That's all. We won't do it again. On the balls. Well, as long as the skipper was willing to let his engine room run automatically, his engine room didn't run. Why? Because you didn't have very many people who could run engines. Tells you any ship in which anybody's not interested goes to hell. And it tells you anybody, in which the fellow isn't being caused 24 hours of the day goes to hell. I don't care whether you're talking about its eyesight or its liver or anything else, it goes to hell just like a ship. It's just a complex organism which is set up automatically. Now, that doesn't mean you should do all of your breathing, but it's a good thing once in a while. What do you know? To stop your breathing and start it again. It'll make you live for a while, you know. Breathing machine's never going to go to pieces if you do it. I'll show you what I mean. Here's a beautiful example of automaticity. Now take a breath. Now let it out. Now just take the normal kind of a breath that you take. Now let it go a little quicker than you ordinarily do. Now take another normal breath. Now let it go. Now take another normal breath. Now let it go. Another normal breath. Now let it go. Normal breath. Now let it go. Now take a normal breath and hold it a little longer. Now refuse to let it go. And let it go. What's happened to your breathing now? Did you go on having to breathe? Huh? Did it really lapse back into automaticity or just go on breathing? Or did you have to go on breathing? I'm very unwilling to upset your breathing for the rest of the time. But do you see that I very well could with that process? I could set it up for the next month. You'd have to remember to take every breath. Boy, you'd consider this a real hardship. And you'd say, well, gosh, all of my attention would be occupied then with breathing. Would it? You mean you'd have that much more attention is what it means. Anytime you can find something to put your attention on that you're regulating, you have that much more attention. And nobody ever realized that. They think it's the reverse. They think attention is a finite quantity. They think a fellow is born with 2.5 quarts of attention. You can get Steinle so that you can go clear across the boards with it. You can make the heart beat. You can make the blood flow. You can do all of these things. The lads over in the mountains over in India used to do this. They did it the wrong way too, and to the opposite ends of the poles, as far as I could see when I was a kid. They would take over these functions one by one. Yogi is the process of trying to take over these functions. They try to make this the end-all and regainment of. And then they write a book saying, the various centers of awareness of the body are, and then they name seven of them, and one is the serpent, and one is the dog, and it's very interesting, very complex. But one's the corona, and I don't know whether they thought the corona was a thetan or not, but I know there is a ball of fire in where they say the corona is. That used to be an old eye. And here we have the how to actually liberate these centers. You start at the furthest one from the thetan, and they bog you down with the problem of can you exteriorize an entity? By the time anybody has worked on one and two and three and four, he sees number seven. Why, he's got himself so doggone thoroughly out of control and in re-stimulation, but he'll never get out of his body. It's very simple. I know because I worked this. This the malice of forethought. I saw the book of the Shakir and looked it over, and oh, gosh, I must be about 15. I got real curious about it. I started asking people about this darn book. And I ran across it not too long ago, gorgeous pictures and so forth. Ran across it, and I said, I wonder. Now, that's very interesting. It's very funny that a person answers up on the meter to the names given to these areas. And the meter bongs every time you answer him up on one. It's very curious. And so I started to exteriorize somebody in that time. They didn't talk about exteriorization. They merely talked about the rehabilitation of that center. I thought, well, the best rehabilitation that center could have is give it a boot. So let's just exteriorize it, one right after the other, on up the line. And I got to center number three, and the whole case fell in on me. I'm doing it very nicely, too, very carefully, well within the auditor's code and everything else. Real grim. In other words, it really pinned the fellow down. It's like Bishop Sheen the other night. He doesn't have very much sheen, so don't hold it against him. Uh-huh. He was talking about everybody had to have a hard head and a soft heart. The brain had to become solid. That was it. And what God really wanted people to have was a completely solid brain and a completely soft heart. Now, this is great. I mean, this is a wonderful allegory. The only trouble is it seems to be straight in the teeth of clearing, isn't it? And of course, no tradition has ever come down the line that people mustn't be free. There mustn't be such a... never would be, naturally. I mean, nobody of that character who was trying to sell saints would ever try to unconvince other people that they weren't. So you see, naturally, that supposition is very libelous against the church. That's an inverted seventh dynamic. Very often you don't get any place with an inverted seventh dynamic unless you waste ghosts. Somebody's been into spiritualism, something, you waste ghosts in bracket. All right, now we're not off the subject 2 inches when we're talking about this. But we're talking about step two, and we're talking about automaticity. When this fellow, you ask this fellow to get out of his body, he who has gone into very deep automaticities, and he's actually down below 3 or 4 or 5, you wouldn't ordinarily do very much to this case, but just go on down the line, except with clinical procedure. You have to know all this about all the case levels on a step two basis. In other words, what is step two to all cases? Well, step two to all steps is the automaticity of that step. And somebody who cannot bring himself to discard this much automaticity, one body, is going to require a little more work before he exteriorizes. And that's what step two tells you, and that's why mock up the person's body. Mock up his body, mock up his body. Normally, if you just kept on mocking up his body for 5 or 10 minutes, he'd exteriorize. If you just kept this up, unless he's in the effort band. You got to put lots of effort into things. You got to just get him so he's real good on effort and thinkingness into everything under the sun. And when he's real good at that, he'll be able to exteriorize. Because, why? He can't work. Because the body does all the work. And the one common denominator of all cases difficult to exteriorize, the one common denominator, difficult to exteriorize, and below that level, what they have called neurotic, psychotic personalities, they have one common denominator that goes clear across the boards, is they can't put out much effort. And the less effort a case can put out, the worse communication the case is in, the communication state the case is in, and the less he will exteriorize. You follow this? He can't put out effort. If he can't handle effort. So when you get a case there, he is either fixed on the idea that he's got to handle effort, in other words, he's got to work, he's got to put out effort, or he's in a position where he can't anymore. So you fall into the two categories of work, which immediately mean effort. And there is your index. There is a beautiful index. You ask this person to discard a piece of automaticity. What automaticity? Are you asking him to park off of there for just 3 minutes or 2 minutes or 1 minute? You're asking him to park that piece of automaticity called a body off there. If he can't put it away from him 4 or 5 feet for a minute or so, believe me, he thinks he has to have it do practically everything for him. It has to think for him and work for him and sweat for him and do the emoting for him. He gets convinced on this one way or the other, and the thing for you to do is simply to bust the conviction. Now, we can actually actively bust a case and run a case with just steps 1 and 2. But we can't take one of these steps and carry it along independently of the other step because we keep running into the machinery. We ask this fellow, now, all right, now where aren't you in the room and all that sort of thing, and all of a sudden he's outside of his head, and he says, I must be looking at the facsimile of the body, but I know the body is out there someplace. I'm certain I'm outside, but I just can't really see the body very well, and I don't quite know several things about the body, you know. He's just in a situation there where he has a failure because of a machine that hands him facsimiles rather than handing the real McCoy. Now, you can go complete reverse and say there's a reason for it. Anytime you say that there's a reason first and an action second, you're trying to reverse and invert this looking as condensed feeling scale. See? You're saying the thinking that's down here is senior to the effort which is immediately above it. See? So the reason for this fellow doesn't want to get out of his body, so he does so-and-so. Oh, that's fallacy. It's fallacy. You're making a mistake when you do that. He doesn't have any reason why he wants to get out of his body. He's lost all of his reasons. He's got lots of reasons now, and he'll tell you lots of reasons, but these are justifications. And they're merely after the fact. And the fact is, one, he starts to lose himself geographically by setting up automaticities. In other words, he keeps looking around for the bridge ladders, and the bridge ladders aren't there. See that? He's nowhere there is a bridge ladder anymore. There are people all over here who are thoroughly trained for space opera. Oh, just gorgeously trained for space opera. They're gorgeously trained to be couriers on another planet. They're just wonderfully trained, and their bodies are wonderfully trained to be hunters. The only thing they can hunt is something in a hat and silk stockings. Now, nothing to hunt. See. Here are all these mislocated beings. They're mislocated in place and they're mislocated in time. And the culture is not the kind of a culture they're trained to be located in. And so they're completely lost. And they've been saying for thousands of years, where the hell am I? That's the first thing anybody says when he's been knocked over his head. You could drive a little dog insane simply by banging him on the head. And while he was unconscious, moving him into the next room and standing him on his head in the corner and letting him come to in that fashion. A little dog the rest of his life would go around saying, I know I didn't go. I just know I didn't go out with my head down in that corner in that room. So the two places are trying to be collapsed by these two dogs. He's here while he's here, but this first room must be then this second room. The dirtiest thing you could do to a guy is slip an anesthetic mask over his face in one room, operate on him in another room, and let him wake up in a ward. Why not just shoot him? Unless he gets processing, he's going to be lost for the rest of time. Where? Just where you found him stuck on the time track, in an operation or something of the sort, or in an accident. All right? The fellow hits with a terrific impact, goes unconscious, and the plane or the car bounces and goes someplace else. And then somebody drags him out of the thing while he's unconscious. And they put him in a car, and they drive him to some town. No wonder, when people have been knocked out, the first question they ask is, where am I? First question they can think of when they come back. Because they've got a machine, all their machinery is set to go on geographical locations and positions. And as soon as they're transferred suddenly from one geographical location to another geographical location, they lose their sequence of positions. And when their sequence of positions are gone, they can no longer get from one stage of the machinery to another stage of the machinery, and the automaticity is lost, and so they must be somebody else. They're living another life. Death to another life is just that mechanism and no other mechanism. Now, this person, you ask this person, well, how have people lived before? Why, they, of course, know their name and so forth. Well, no, they don't even know when they went to school in the former life. They're bad off. Here they've got all this automatic education, which goes into fine furor and fury every time they try to study something. You know, it just blasts them. All of a sudden, this person, they just can't study arithmetic. No accounting for this. He can't study arithmetic. Well, if you went back down the track or something or other, they were one of the most well-known authorities on Newton or something of the sort at some other university in some other time. Arithmetic, be damned, they were mathematicians. You start them up now with new stimulus response mechanisms, new automaticity. The second he starts to make arithmetic automatic, he's already, as long as he's still cause where arithmetic is concerned, starts to make it automatic so that he knows the multiplication table automatically, and pang, he loses his geographical positions because he's already lost them on the subject of mathematics. These geographical positions mix. He thinks he's after that someplace else with regard to arithmetic. He can't study arithmetic. He goes mad. You say, 1 + 1 equals what? And he says, 6, I guess. Is that right? See what happens on automaticity and mixture geographical positions. You can't take the subject of automaticity and throw away the subject of geography. And the only place you lose an automaticity and become really unconscious of one is when you set one up in position A and start using it from position B. And your preclear that's holding on to some part of the track is trying to hold on to the connective sequence between his automaticity so he doesn't lose his sequences of geographical positions. If you restore to him his sequences of geographical positions, if they can fall into line, then the time track unravels and all of his machinery stretches out into time where it belongs. I don't know how long it'd take to do this, but it's plenty long.